My mother's people, all of them were fishermen. My father's people, all of them were fishermen. And, well, I couldn't go farming, so I was going to be a fishing family.
Were they ground fishermen?
There was everything. Of course, when father and grandfather was in it, they went trawling and henline in. Had to do it by hand. That's before they even got the fish nets to drag with. And my father, when he was a young man, he learned how to do that from different ones that were experimenting with nets. And his most efficient teachers was the fisherman down to Pemaquid Point.
And that was to learn how to use draggers?
That was know how to make a net that you could drag, make it work right. They were experimenting with them. But this town was quite a few fishermen in here with net draggers.
Were they otter trawls or were they...
Otter trawls. Beam trawls has a beam on it. That's why they call it a beam trawl. Yeah. Otter trawls, you use these doors, it's like a kite, goes on the bottom and they spread it.
So that's what they were learning?
Yeah.
The new... That was down, you said, down lower mid-coast there, but...
Well, that's where Father got a lot of his information from that helped him make those nets. And that was down New Harbor. There were several fellas in there that was making these nets and towing them off Pemaquid. There wasn't any shops in those days, by the way.
Do you think most of the innovations come from guys fishing as opposed to the shops?
Oh, yes. Shops didn't help. Didn't help us nothing until they become a store for us. Mm-hmm. Then they helped us.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go to them then. But the fisherman itself was the force behind it.
Before they were using that then, who was anybody handlining there?
Oh, yes, they were all handlining. They handline and they trawl. I mean, they don't trawl. They used long lines with hooks on them. We call them trawl.
I know gill netting kind of came and went.
Well, gill netting came and went, yes. But they had those gill nets even before they had the trawls, because they would just set them out in a little cove somewhere, anchor them out there, buoy them off, so they spread out like a curtain, and then the fish would get meshed in them.
And was it a preferred species going after those? You know, big mesh size for ground?
They tried to. Like they would try, they had macro nets, so macro a little small, so their mesh is much smaller, probably 3 inches or 2.5 or something. They had herring nets that was even smaller than that, to gill them the same way. They would not have many macro in those because macro was a bigger fish than herring. Macro would go right through a codfish net or a haddock net that was a gill net. So codfish and haddock would get caught into a gill net that was made for them because their meshes were bigger. Let's see, they was getting up into 3.5-4 inches.
You're trying to select for a good mature ground fish then, huh?
Yeah, you could select pretty good, yeah. Then you didn't have to be contented with other kind of fish in there, see.
They ever get fouled up by seals or humpbacks or anything?
Always, yeah, when they're around, but... That didn't happen so much that it bothered you too much. Because they was in coves and places like that where they set the net. Then they set them out in deeper water in places. And if whales get into one, they probably drag the thing off and you never find it anyway. But the other fish, porpoises and stuff, I never heard of them being snarled up in there to bother much.
Now, is this mostly inshore fishing we're talking about, say within 5 miles of,
well,
5-10 miles of shore?
Let me put it this way. My grandfather, he was a fisherman. So he had, the first son he had was Phil Raines. He used to live in Camden until he died. Now, he didn't like going offshore on deep water. He liked it around the shore to go fishing. He always went fishing, by the way. So he fished up along Camden, going up Lincolnville and up the river there. He had all those little bottoms up there. He studied them, and he used to set nets up there, and he used to set trawls up there. And they would catch haddock and cod. In those days, they would go up there in certain time of the spring And that's when he would catch them, and they would just peddle them.
Now, was he fishing in those deep channels that are running up there? I know, like, out off Northport and some of those places there.
He knew most all those places. Now, my father, he went with my grandfather, and they lived down here. They lived in Tinicus. They lived Port Clyde for a while. So they fished offshore, and they go offshore hand lining for fish, and hand lining fish. Father liked it out there. See, they go off the night before and set their trawls, and then they lay there all night and haul them in the morning. He liked it out there where it was clear and nobody around in the way and that sort of stuff. Phil didn't like it. You get seasick out there. That was So he didn't like that.
They didn't fish together much then.
Not too much, but he went out there with grandfather and father some, and that's how I knew he got seasick, because he didn't like that out there. So he liked it up the bay, and he always made his living right there at the Camden. And somebody interviewed Phil a few years ago, probably 20 years ago or something. He's been gone quite a while. But he was telling about catching fish up along Lincolnville and those places. I don't know who recorded that, but I remember hearing it somewhere.
Oh, okay.
And hopefully father and grandfather, they went down off Matinicus. They liked it offshore better.
They ever, back then, was there, once in a while I would read about people catching the odd salmon or two in their nets.
No, I never heard him say much about that. No, I don't know.
Well, I found some, maybe it was actually from around 1900 or so, when they were just getting some fishery agent was going around to the islands and asking them. They were trying to track the salmon there. So there was it was an open fishery anyway, but it was just some there and then some...
some other place.
Some off of Northport. You know, a few places, I guess, where they're coming up to do their migration, holes they like to go, and they just figure out after a while where to catch them, I guess. Now, the Matinicus guys, are they, was there any sword fishing close in?
No. I never heard of sword fishing until I grew up anyway.
But if you're hand lining around the Matinicus and Port Clyde and Monhegan Falls, there's a lot of different...
There'd be tuna out there in the summer when it's right, but swordfish, very seldom see there. I should correct myself, because when I was dragging, in the 80s, we decided to go try catching swordfish by harpooning. So we did. We rigged out and went for several years.
Did you have to go out to George's, or were
we went all the way to George's. We chased those fellows from Rhode Island. They taught us how to rig up and so forth. So we fished out there, and it was getting towards the decline of the great amount of swordfish. We went off in there in 1980, and we stayed there probably 8 years, 8 or 10 years, which was just a summer fishery is all it was. But it was a relief from the other type.
What was your job on a sword boat?
Well, I rigged her out for sword fishing. And I was enthused about going sword fishing, so I became the striker and the captain, of course. That's why I rigged her up, so I could have the excitement of sticking them. That was the best part of it, anyway.
Well, I met a gentleman up in southwest Nova Scotia who was doing the same thing. He was a French guy.
Yeah, some of those fellows were good. And we fished with them. Well, I got a picture around the corner there. Mm-hmm. That's the picture of it anyway.
This is the one you were sword fishing on?
Yeah.
Was that a rig up there? I can't quite tell from the picture there.
They call it a pulpit.
Okay.
I mean, I don't preach or anything.
Didn't you give them their last rites?
You don't have time to give them anything. When you see one, you've got to go right at it quick. Ain't got time to think of anything else.
When you're harpooning, where's the best place to strike them?
right in the top of his back where the fin sticks out.
But sometimes would that just paralyze him right off?
No. Oh, heck no. They were wild. Of course, they didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stick something in like that. The best way to get him, if you can, is drive it right down through him. And they call that buttonholing it.
That'll put it down quicker.
No, he can swim for hours with that in him.
Oh, but he ain't getting away.
Getting away, because if you buttonhole in him, he can't get away.
Could I ask what the name of this vessel is?
Irene Elton.
Oh, my gosh, okay. Is this...
Yeah.
Huh? And that's the Irene Elton that people are trying to buy right now?
Well, right there on the hook. Yeah. Oh, you can see it out the window there. It's the only dragger out there.
Did you build the Irene Elton?
Yes.
Was that here in Owl's Head?
Well, just a mile from the harbor here. Then we had to have it towed over here. You can take those pictures with you.
So these are different times in his career then, certainly these two, or is this roughly the same time?
No, those two there are the draggers, when it's rigged for dragging.
Okay.
And we only went sword fishing, of course, in the summer. But that was in the 80s, we went sword fishing.
And so when were you dragging?
Before and after, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you've been a one-boat person for a lot of your career?
Well, one boat. Yeah, I guess it's one boat. I don't know.
Well,
oh, you mean one single boat?
Yeah, the Irene Elton. You fished that one for most of your fishing career?
No. Well, you come over here and I explain it to you about it.
Oh, okay.
This is my museum. It ain't very big. But anyway, when I grew up, father had a boat built 1950 in Vinyl Haven. That's 52 feet. That's the dragon. That's what he had, see.
The Ethel B.
Yeah. And that's in Portland now. That was just a few years ago, probably 10 years ago. Her picture, her boat's right there in Portland Harbor, tied up beside the wharf. The one that I've got there now is 58 feet. It's just 8 feet longer. They're both pretty much the same shape.
Was the Ethel B built in this area also?
Vinyl Haven. I was 18 years old when he launched it. And after I got to school, I went fishing with him on that. So it was just father and I had it. This is John the Coco. That's the first hand he had when he first got a rig. John was quite a fat fellow, but a jolly one. This is not quite the size of the model that fits. Then Ellen and I, we bought this one here. It was a sardine boy.
The Ruth Mary.
Ruth Maris, he's 83, Pauline, and the Jacob Pike, and all those, they're all the same. So we bought this from that sardine factory in Portland when they sold out. And we rigged that for dragging. She was in the shipyard in Stonington. Mm-hmm. We went over and got her, and that's the way she looked. So we had her hauled out, and they put sheathing on that side. And we painted the bottom and all that. She'd been sitting there for a couple of years. So we cleaned her up and had her on the railway to do that. Then we put sheathing, because that's where the doors would come up, one there and one down by the stern. And we went dragging with it for shrimping and fish dragging for 2-3 years. And then the tanks was leaking inside because she was already 20 years old. But we'd have to pump off when we get outside because there would be oil slicked on the bilge water coming out of those tanks. So when we made money enough, 2-3 years later, we had to haul out Newbert and Wallace and Thomaston, and they let us, me and my uncle, work board of her. So we tore the house off the stern. They put a new house up on the bow. And that's another picture of her there, she could hope for. Because when we was fishing, she looked like this. See, she had the house out just like it is here. This is the actual model of her. The way she was a sardine carrier.
Did you build it?
No. Richard Newman Wallace built it, I think.
No, I meant the model?
Oh, yes, I built that, yeah.
So where is she today, do you know?
Well, the last that I knew, she was in Gloucester. Whether she's there still or not, I don't know. But we had a house put on the bow up here, mm-hmm. And we tore all this off because we had to get those tanks out. Mark and I cleaned that all off. You took that wheelhouse off, set it in the dooryard.
Is that when you rigged it for Dragon?
No, we was rigged for Dragon. We was rigged for Dragon the first year we had him. And we put the galluses on the other side, had a side rig for the house aft, just like that. But it was messy in the engine room, see. We had to do something about those tanks, so we had them hauled out and put in, made brand new ones and put them back in there. But while they was doing it, Roy Wallace, which owned the shipyard there in Thomaston, he built the house, put it on forward, see. And then when it got done, we had the tanks lowered it down in there and plumbed her up. Then he come back here and decked her over, and we was ready to go over.
Now, did you find, generally, one handled better in a, or differently in a storm than another? It just looks like they're kind of different hull configurations.
Well, this here is Father's model, and the one I got out there is a model that he made in the barn. He wanted this one be built like that one out there. But, well, they wouldn't let the engine get down in here underneath the wheelhouse where we wanted it. So he had this made over by Navy architect on Vinyl Haven. He was a doctor. And he designed this over just a little bit. So this one here can go down the wall and ground out. See that man, when he stands up to it, that's only 6 feet up the waterline. But this one up here is 8 feet.
Now, what about this boat up here?
No, that was Father's when he was a young man. He went lobstering.
Was that right? It looks a little sporty or something, almost as if it... almost as if he converted a sailboat, but I'm not...
No. No, that's just powerboat like they had on Matinicus there in the early 1900s. They were most all was rigged that way. They put a little cabin up here. Usually the cabin is only about that long, but anyway... They put a little cabin up here, and you stood out in the weather and hauled your traps down here and say, you'll never get in under the weather. We didn't have sense enough to make the cabin
well,
on it. Like
you had a little cuddy, though, right?
Yeah, a little cuddy, so get inside. In fact, when they first went off hen lining and sent in trawls outside of Cree Haven and the Raw, that's where they slept and eat in there, see? Because they'd set the trawls, and then they would turn in for the night.
And just let the trawls soak.
Yeah. And then next morning, they'll start daylight, see, hauling it.
And do they have a potholder? Or, I mean, some kind of hauler for their lines?
This is the engine, see. And then they'll take the rear end of an automobile, or the junkyard. That goes down this way, the shaft, where one wheel would be right here. The other one would be cut off. Go down where the notch is, it goes to the shaft up under the car, and then put a V pulley here and a V pulley in front of the engine, and that's what run it. It was turned that winch head right there.
So great little power block then.
Well, didn't know anything about power blocks those days. So you wrap your rope around that, and that'd help you pull it. And most everybody used them. Stay up there. Most everybody used them for hauling traps in those days. Yeah.
Here's a little tool on there. It looks like it's seen a few years. Is that a couple of gauges? Old lobster gauges?
Well, yes. I haven't got the real old one. Real old. Oh, that's an old one there. They just had for the small measure. This is one of the first ones. See, they got the initials on there, Sea and Shore Fisheries. If you can see it.
Just barely, but yeah.
Yeah. And this is just the small measure. We didn't have no big measure then.
And why was that? What does that mean? That there was
there was
no maximum size, but there was a minimum size?
I believe so, yeah. It was 4 hours before I ever went fishing. So then they come out with these here where they had bus sizes. That's what we have today.
About when was that? Do you remember?
1920, I suppose, like that.
So they were serving lobster all that time?
Oh, yeah, one way or two. I don't know how many years they could take the big ones, but that's how they started, I guess. And they had a change once or twice in my lifetime with the size of this one here, I guess.
The reason you went fishing was because your father, your grandfather,
Oh yeah.
Other relatives. It was a good living, and it's something that everyone was skilled in.
Well, everybody in both families went fishing. See, all my brothers, my mother's brothers and sisters, all the brothers went fishing. Almost every one of them. And half of them was lost at sea, which made it not so nice for her, but that was the nature of it. They went down to Bedford and went scalloping and dragging out of there.
So these weren't Maine boats that they were getting lost on? It was
they were all Massachusetts boats.
They were going off to Georges and Grand Banks and places?
Yeah. Yeah, because they wanted to make more money. They wanted to go into the bigger fleet and that sort of stuff. So they all ended up going down there.
Yeah. Well, risky. And what about the inshore guys? Mostly...
When I was a kid, they was all inshore. You know, Harris, when they showed up here, just about the time I was a kid, he brought in some pretty good size boats from Portland and from Boston, because he come down originally from Boston, I guess. And they were after redfish, what they wanted. Redfish was a plentiful fish out here, easy to catch compared to some of them. They were there year-round. It's not just summertime. Mm-hmm. You know, in the wintertime they'd be gone. They were there all year-round. So it made it good for them, and it made it good because they had a supply year-round for years and years. 40 Fathoms was another big company in Rockland that made their living with redfish. So they set up their cutters, you know, the machines, in their factories just for those redfish. And a redfish that's a big one, and that's a smaller one. And not a lot of difference between them. So. So the machine would handle almost all of them. If they had some real jumbos, I don't know, they might have had to change one machine for it, or they might have people hand cut it or something.
But they were mostly within that size limit the machines could handle.
Yeah, they made it good that way. Other fish, you see, they're small and then they're big. It's quite a difference.
So those were O'Hara's boats?
O'Hara's had a fleet here, and 40 Fathoms had a fleet. Mm-hmm. And he owns both docks now, and he just has it for yachts. But 40 Fathoms, I guess they come from Canada, I ain't sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where they come from. They had quite big boats. They were big steel boats, 110 like that, 120.
What were you fishing at the time then? Were you working for them, or were you fishing your...
No, I only fished with Father, and that was one of his boats in there, his last big one that he had. That was that little one in there, 52 feet.
What did having companies like O'Hara do as far as your ability to sell your catch? Did it start controlling the price of the catch or anything by having these other boats offloading here?
Not at the beginning, because they had their own fleet for their own supply, and redfish was all they really was after. What we was catching was the ground fish that's on the market, you know, cod, haddock, and pollock, and all that stuff you see in the market now. So there was other buyers in Rockland that bought them. In fact, if O'Hara's had some of those fish they saved out, that crew would save the last day, they would sell it to these buyers instead of O'Hara, because O'Hara didn't want them. All he wanted was a redfish.
But did 40 Fathoms also, were they focusing on redfish?
Same thing, yeah. Yeah, they had quite a fleet.
What was the redfish market? I mean, was that...
The biggest market, I do believe, was the U.S. government soldiers. Feed them and so forth. Yeah.
Because I never thought of it as being that big in the seafood case.
Oh, yes. I think that was a way of feeding a mass majority of people in a cheaper way than buying them beef and all this other stuff.
Does it handle well as a type of fish as far as processing and keeping it fresh? Or maybe they're probably just throwing it in the can if they're taking it off to the soldiers.
It was the same way. No, they cut them and they candled them, which means they put them over a light. Any worms or anything or defects in them, they'd cut them out. The women would clean them off nice, and then they'd freeze them, see? And that's how they shipped them from there, stored them, shipped them, had them frozen. So they sent them off to the markets wherever they could get. And I thought the best market was supplying the soldiers, because we had quite a fleet. Come Second World War, they had a good market then, especially.
As far as the other ground fish, how much candling was necessary?
They all should have been, because worms will get into all fish, but some was worse than others. And season, different part of the season of the year, mm-hmm. they'd be worse than others. So it didn't mean you had to candle them all the time. It might have been just in the fall, perhaps they were wormy then.
They've gotten big enough to be...
Well, it's whatever they eat, I suppose, that would cause them to be eating worms, getting their skin or something.
They weren't poisonous. It was just people who didn't want to be eating worms with their fish.
I think so. If you didn't like it, you picked it out. Huh. If you didn't mind it, you just ate it. Here she comes with
my goodness.
So you better look this over. She probably got worms in it.
We were talking about candling the fish and the... Some of them had more worms in different seasons than others. And
yeah, I think so.
Any of them that you never bothered having to check?
We never had to check any of them. They wanted to check them after.
Oh, that was up to them.
Sure, that was up to them. If we dressed a fish and they was all wormy, we wouldn't even bring it in.
Hmm.
And some would be that way, and usually it was up in the nape. You know what the nape is?
Kind of
you
know, below the gills?
The stomach, mm-hmm. and you're cutting across the throat. Well, that was the nape, that three-cornered
piece.
When it
opened, yeah.
And sometimes that would be full of worms. And we could either cut that nape right off, if the fish was big enough, and bring the rest of the fish in, there wouldn't be any worms in it. Or we could just throw them away.
If you checked one and then you checked another and found a lot of worms, you'd have to just let that whole toe go?
No, we never had them. It seemed to be... Just once in a while, a few fish would get wormy. I don't know if they swam off in it and fed at a different area that caused them to be wormy or what it was, but it would be noticeable enough so we wouldn't bring them in.
You know, at the fish forum, guys were talking about how since now they've got a... If they catch any cod, they have to throw them back once they're over just a few hundred pounds. While you were fishing ground fish over these years... Were there ever restrictions like that said you couldn't bring this species in, only that one?
No, that's only been the last 10 years, I guess, or whatever. Because that's a waste to make you do or something like that.
It just drives these guys to despair, the whole idea of all this great protein on the hoof there.
Yeah, I know.
You were involved in some of the hook fishery yourself?
I used to set trawls when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Wintertime, Father, it was hard to catch fish enough to make a go. So we bought a lobster boat, 38 feet. I was getting to be a teenager then. And I used to go with him in the winter, hauling traps down Green Island Ridge. That's about a two-hour run from here. When it comes to spring, I used to bait the trawl the day before. I had to go to school. When it comes Saturday, he'd depend on me, go out with him, help haul the traps down the ridge, see. So I'd take the trawl and we'd set it out the minute we get down there. He'd pick out a place where it'd be away from the traps and mm-hmm. stuff, and we'd set that trawl out and buoy it off on both ends. Then we go haul his traps, and before we come in, we go haul that trawl again. Sometimes I'd take a dory with me. A couple of times I took my dory, and we set that trawl when he got there, and he went and hauled traps. I hauled the trawl and baited it again and set it out. That worked pretty good, but I only did that a few times. So I get a few fish that I could peddle when I get home. That's what I was after.
Hmm. Did you ever have them soaking overnight?
Oh, yes. We often did that, because that was one of the ways of doing it. And you could haul them the next morning.
Were anybody able at that time to make a living trawling?
Oh, yeah.
That kind of trawling?
Oh, yes. A lot of them made a living. A lot of them on Vinyl Haven, every summer they went after hake. Hake would show up here pretty plentiful along the island, and they trawl for them all summer. Well, it was a big business over there for a while.
Do you think that the gentlemen who were in Port Clyde right now that are dragging for ground fish, do you think it'd be economically profitable for them to try tub trawling instead of otter trawling?
Oh, I don't think so. That's going backwards. That's the way you caught them, well, when the good Lord was living around Galilee and those places, they went otter trawling. Tub trawling, mm-hmm. I guess you call it.
Well, hook fisher, I just wondered if the days at sea have been cut down so hard, and you can only catch so much. Yeah. It just seemed like it's less gear to less expensive to set up to tub trawl than it is to set up on a small boat.
Well, it probably is, but it was a lot of hand work, which is a lot of work for catching one fish with tears. So that's why they invented these nets to trawl, you know, drag along on the bottom to catch fish. And I ain't too sure. I think probably that they developed that over in Europe quicker than we did here. So we learned a lot from them. But like I say, when Father got into it, he learned from those fellows down New Haven, down along the coast, different ones that he knew was fishermen, and they always talked with him back and forth. So they taught him what little they knew, and he taught him what little he knew. They'd pass information back and forth, which helped each other.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the years go by, see, most all those fellas died off. And then I was left with going fishing without my father, because people don't live forever.
People do leave logbooks behind.
Yeah.
I've met a couple of guys who said they just didn't keep them all, you know, or regret it later on.
Yeah, so did I. I went down Rhode Island to see how to rig up for sword fishing. And I took my logbook with me, and that was as much as 15 years prior to that logbook was filled in through there. I took it for information about where we had been fishing, where we'd have to go catch swordfish. Well, somebody broke in my truck, and they stole the logbook and my jacket, and I don't know what else in there, in the middle of the night, so I lost that one. I had a few of the old ones, but nothing as good information as that one I had, so I lost my best one. Yeah.
Why do you think someone would steal that?
Oh, because it had a shiny cover, I guess. That was down in Rhode Island. When I was sleeping at night, I slept with my cousin over there in his place, and we had to park out in front of his apartment. The next morning, she'd be broken into, and there was just a jacket and a logbook that I could find it was gone. I missed that years later when I wanted to rig up for sword fishing, because it had a lot of the information. The last 10 years I've been fishing, or 15, I had been fishing before that. It does mean quite a lot having a logbook to look back on. You can find stuff that you couldn't remember. Now I find out I can't remember half of any of it now. It's even worse.
How many logbooks do you have left?
I got two left over there now. But
covers a few years, does it?
Yes, probably 15 each one. 12 or 15.
And was that all on the Irene Alton?
No, that was in the Ruth Mary, that big one that was in there. She was 80 feet. We had that for about 10 years. And we sold it, and I built this one in the dooryard.
I was seeing this here. That was the scrapbook is all about that, as far as I can tell.
Well, pretty much, yeah.
Oh, okay. And here it is, back in 98, still, or 85.
Yeah, that's over since you were up to the Rockland Fish Pier, yeah. Yeah.
Rockland Fishing Fleet. Isn't that amazing to be able to say, you know, the last the last groundfish boats of Rockman's fishing fleet.
I guess so.
At least for now, have hung up their nets. But do your logbooks then would give you an idea about seasonally what, where the fish were?
Well, the years, early years was, we had marks, see, to find out where the bottom was, because we didn't have any machines or anything. Mm-hmm. So we used marks for a different toll. Father would mark them down, so I'd copy them off, so I'd have them. Uncle Phil, when he fished just up the river, he wouldn't go out in offshore with Father, because, like I told you, he'd get seasick. So he had marks going up along Camden and up Lincolnville, all up through the river, all those little banks there where fish would show up in the spring. So we had marks for them, so we could get on that piece of bottom. See.
Now, are marks different features of the landscape that you can run up against each other to,
right.
when they're abreast of each other or
That's right.
whatever?
Yeah.
Ah.
And one of the best marks we had, like down below here, off Muscle Ridge Channel and outside of Matinee.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best marks we had was the cement plant. At that time, it had two stacks. And you could line up those stacks with each other, or close them in until they become like one. Or you could put them over a lighthouse that was down on the shore somewhere, or a mountain that was up and back, and that's how you found those spots offshore again.
So you had a good, steady,
major
one that's always clear. To,
yeah, as long as it was clear, you could use it good. And then when they took the stack down, we lost a lot of those marks because those two stacks here was most of it. I used to love that. It was easy to go off when it was clear to find out where the toes was down below Matinic and alongside them and Higgin, between there and Matinicus and those places. That was one of the greatest marks.
You are listening to a recording of Bernard Raines, March 15, 2007.
So then the Second World War come along, and when it did, and the war got over, there was a lot of surplus stuff. One of the surplus stuff that we all bought was a Loran that was developed during the war so that they could tell where you was, whether you was in an airplane with one of those machines or you was in a boat offshore with one of those machines, mm-hmm. you could tell where you was. See. So then after the war, there was a lot of them in surplus and we could buy them. But they was in the infancy of being developed, which is a hard thing to work them. Now you just turn a switch, like you do that funny thing there, and it does it all itself. See, but in those days, we had to turn a knob, and we got a little window with blips on it. And that would one station might be up in way up in Aroostook, another one might be way down east, and a third one would be way down off Massachusetts, like off Nantucket someplace, or Martha's Vineyard, one of those. So they would give you a signal. And I think how it went was a signal from Martha's Vineyard would send a signal out to way up in Aroostook, and they'd bounce it back. You know, this circle going up there and that circle coming back. And if you were somewhere between the two, you see you would get those two receivers.
And you could kind of tune it till the...
And you tune it till you're in. But
and it would tell you where you were then.
It did, but you had to go through quite a process because we had three different power settings to go through the process. In other words, you get a signal from up in Aroostook and one from Martha's Vineyard, and when they come by, you would get that signal. You might be near Massachusetts, or you might be almost up in Aroostook, but your boat won't float. But wherever you was, that would give you those two coming by each other. So then you switch it, and what you did, you magnified it up greater.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, they looked like a telephone pole. And then you put them right behind each other. That's as close as you could get, so you'd switch it to third position, and then they come up like a mountain, and that front edge of both of those mounted, you had to put them together.
And then it would give you some kind of reading.
Yeah. It would take you probably half a minute to do that when you got good. Took me over a minute to do it when I first got the damn machine.
It sounds about as hard to learn that as it was to learn the marks.
Well, it was, but if it was thick of fog and rainy like it is now, and you couldn't see the mark, this was the next best thing. And it came out good right after the war, and everybody was buying them, and we were studying it. Ernie Cavanaugh taught me how to run the thing. Father never had one.
What about depth finders?
Depth finders, they come out from after the war. They were cheap enough so we could buy them, too. And that's when we started putting them in.
Was that putting out a paper?
We had paper and we had flashes. Of course, the paper one, the paper was going by the window, and the little stylus was marking the depth. Mm-hmm. See? And the flasher was a big round. Well, it would probably be 10 inches square, the window in the front. And then it was round in a circle, and it went from zero, of course, to 100 fathoms.
Mm-hmm.
She'd flash wherever the depth was.
Well, that really changed things then, because instead of dropping lead lines down.
Yeah.
So what happened to all that knowledge that got gained by all this doing it by hand? You know?
Well, it stayed with Father, and it stayed with these sardine carriers. Those sardine carriers were the smartest men on the coast because they had to run day and night and get the load of sardines into the factory, mm-hmm. come in daylight when the women come to work, so they get them pumped out for them, see. So they were going all night long. They'd go out there and catch these fish somewhere, wherever they was sent to get them. There was the rest of the night getting back into port where they had to bring the fish.
Now back then that would be as close as Port Clyde, not all the way up to
everywhere.
Down east and
everywhere. Oh yeah, everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. Well, these factories in Rockland that they built up here, sometimes a lot of them had mother factories down east and some of them had them up Portland even. So those boats, they might send you somewhere else instead of coming into Rockland all the time. So then you had to get through there in the middle of the night so to get to the factory before daylight, if you could do it, see. And that took some going. Those fellows were smart. All those old captains, it was in those sardine boats.
Hmm.
Sherman Lord and his brother. And all these fellows, they steamed those things all night long. Very few ever get ashore somewhere. They usually made it. So they had to go by that little pocketbook or logbook, whatever you want to call it, because they have a course to run from Small Point up here to Rockland and get into Rockland, see. So they'd run for every buoy, every mark. You got to make every one when it's thick of fog before you run to the next one. Otherwise, you don't know where you are, see.
And then you had to take into account the tide and the current?
Yeah. And not only that, but the other thing was in those days, whenever they took the course originally with their watch and their time, and they'd write it down on their little notebook, they went at the steam of the boat, whatever she went, steam, see. If this one made 9 knots, she went 9 knots, and that was so many RPMs on the engine. So they usually run up, even in the thick of fog, that speed, because that's what the log said. I mean, you're going to do a lot of guesswork if you slow that down half RPMs on your engine. So they would run that time out, and then they would shut her off a minute before they get there so they could listen or look, whatever they got to do, see.
Whatever it is, if it's a bellboy or a...
Or if it's a big rock pile going to head you, talking like down off of Whitehead. They get a rock that they still paint it. The Coast Guard still paints it. It's a great big rock on Spruce Head Island. When you come by Whitehead Light and you run by Spruce Head Island, there's a big boulder up there, and it's got a, you know, it's painted all white, and it's got a black stripe like a pole and a round dot.
So it'll grab your eye if you're looking for it.
Yeah, when after you go by the lighthouse, that's the next mark you're going to see out of the fog. Takes you a little while to get there, not a long time, but you run your time out and you find that before you go any further, so you know where you are. If you go too much to the left, you'll run into the island itself. You'll go too much to the right, you see you'll be out in the channel, and you'll miss it. And then you don't ensure where you are until you go to the next one. And that's still there. Nobody uses it anymore, but that's what it was.
But all the time still, I mean, all that time, these two foghorns were going, the Owl's Head and Rockland?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And that one on, I forget the name of the island you said, that's down at the bottom of the Muscle Ridge.
That's Whitehead. In fact, that mark that's on that big boulder there on Spruce Head Island, they had put that out when the steamers were coming up here. Steamboats used to go from Portland to Rockland. They come through the Muscle Ridge Channel.
So those guys had to know that channel really good. Then.
Right. All they had was compass and clock. See,
if you're in the fog and you're halfway through the Muscle Ridge and you miss a buoy, these steamboat guys they knew those grounds pretty well. Then
they had to know it better than we did because they didn't have no sounding machines. See. They missed a buoy. They had to make some adjustments quick because they run the time out and they hadn't made the buoy yet.
That changes everything.
Where is the buoy? Is it on the right side or left side? See? And then they get everybody looking and hunt for that before they go to the next one. It's no fun getting
it. It'd be hairy, isn't it, at that point?
Oh, it is, yeah. By the time the war comes, see, they had surplus. Well, we get sounding machines. That was a help. Mm-hmm. You get the Loran, that helped. Everything helped a little bit, all together.
Now, did auto trawl technology change much over the years?
The time we're talking about was steamboats. Times we're talking about after the steamboats left and they had their sardine factories. Just about the time sardine factories were going the best, that's when they started learning the otter trawl.
You mean that became a common fishing method here in mouth of the bay here?
All over the place, the whole Gulf of Maine, yeah. Because those redfish boats, they went out deep. But like father, with small boats like this, we fished around the shore, see?
I noticed looking at that 1929 book that there's it's a really complicated mass of fishing grounds along the coast, you know, within 5 miles ashore or so.
A lot of them.
It seemed like the fish would just be moving from one to the other.
Well, the fish would show up different grounds, you know, for breeding and for laying eggs and one thing or another. So over the years, people know when they were showing up, what time of year they would show up, see. So as that knowledge get gathered and people shared it with others that was fishing, that's what they relied on pretty much. That's also what each one kept secret for himself and his boy, see. You had friends that fished along the shore that was friends with you and you was with them, they would share some of that. But they also had their own little secrets, too. You know, they'd have holes that they'd found, probably by mistake or by hard fishing, to keep to themselves rather than tell everybody. But the knowledge was around everywhere till they get, after the war, we get those machines where you could hunt the bottom, see. And then some of those got lost. Well, I wouldn't say they got lost, but they found a lot of these holes that the old-timers had in the back of their mind or in a notebook somewhere. They didn't tell it about all of them. They hunted the bottom with lead, see. Now, after the war, we had these sounding machines and things, so we didn't have to use the lead all the time. You could steam over a bottom and that lead was going up and down very fast like that, only it was just the machine doing it. Where before that, gracious, take a man quite a while all day to feel out a piece of bottom if he'd never been there before.
Wasn't there also the advantage of sometimes you could pull up the lead to see what kind of bottom was down there?
Absolutely.
It could be sandy in the middle and mud out on the edges.
Yeah.
So you could tell people have sounded that over the years.
Right. Well, it's the depth, and it tells you what kind of bottom. That's right. And certain kind of bottoms we look for hatcheries, see, where fish would be, lay their eggs and hatch little ones.
Do cod, if they're laying their eggs, do those float off, or do they build little reds like a salmon does, you know, and tuck the eggs on down?
Well, like down off Mount Desert,
mm-hmm.
up towards the mainland, there was areas in there we used to call them. We called them the trees, but that what there was branches of, that growed up from the bottom, I guess. But they would have these, like barnacles and all kinds of stuff that would grow on these little fingers up from the bottom. We'd drag them up, and they would be all hard, like little bony-like trees.
Well, they must have been corals then.
Yeah, it would be. That's right. It's like corals. You can't find any down there much anymore because the dragonfish broke them all up, caught them up, see. But that was a hatchery. Everywhere those was. Because at a certain time of year when they laid their eggs, they'd lay them in amongst those trees and they would stick to it, you know, and keep them from going off in the tide.
Those are fairly deep, weren't they?
These here were down 50 fathom and 40 to 50 fathom like that, as I remember it, where we used to find them.
Because I'd heard of them somewhere up toward Matinicus Rock, too, some of the...
Oh, yes. It was all along the coast.
Now, you said it was near Mount Desert and the mainland?
Well, it was going towards the mainland from Mount Desert, where I remember seeing most of them when we went down there dragging.
Over Frenchman's Bay side?
No, it was right the north and northeast from Mount Desert, not very far from it. Because we used to fish all around it, and we'd find fish around there, so we'd go a little bit further. And by that time, that was after the war, and we had those sounding machines so we could look at the bottom, see. We were dare to go, but if she get rumbling too much, you know, we'd stop or we'd turn around and come back. That means we was getting up on the rocks, and we'd take a chance. Sometimes we'd tear all to pieces, but sometimes we'd get a few fish. And that was the nature of it in those days. Well, it was still that way, I guess. It still get tore up, you see.
Did you have enough repair gear to...
Oh,
fix your basic torn net on board?
Oh, we had to, yeah. Can't bother to run home. Unless there was a major tear up, then you had to go home.
Did you ever, like, lose a whole cod end off?
Mm-hmm. We even lost a whole net.
You mean you had to cut the wire and...
No. No, she just padded. Get too much strain or got too many rocks in it and couldn't get it out. Oh, all kinds of actions we used to have.
It gets a little expensive, too.
Could be. I'd come home, see if the wife give me another dollar bill so I could buy another net.
Yeah. That's very interesting, though, about the eggs could be sticking to those branches and all, because seen some of the underwater video, and often there's nothing else around it. You know, it's like a big empty area with these, then there are these trees.
Yeah.
You know, and this was over off of George's Bank, between George's and Brown's Bank there.
Yeah.
These Canadian guys dove down. But I see redfish hanging out on the branches on some of them.
They're feeding there, see? So that would, you could catch a good trip of fish there.
And it was breaking the current,
but
too.
But we were staving up the tree. So that bottom doesn't produce like it used to on account of that, see? We stove it all out. But a lot of the bottom might be just little pieces of kelp, because kelp will stick onto rocks on the gravelly bottom, and they'll flutter up in the current. And there used to be eggs stuck on them a lot of times. You'd have them dump on deck, and you'd see those eggs stuck to it. So there was some kind of fish. So that was a nursery, which would tell us something.
Would that be closer inshore, shallower water?
No, not necessarily. George's Banks, that's nowhere near shore, but they have a big nursery out there, see.
Now, you fished on George's?
Well, we fished swordfish out there.
Oh, okay.
Well, I scalloped out there, too, for a while.
Your first fishing was lobstering? Or were you first fishing, you know, on board father's boat? Or?
My first fishing was with the father, yeah, because he was already studying how to make nets, to make them work good and so forth, which was shrimp nets and ground fish nets. It was a bigger mesh, of course. And we had a few gill nets that we set out, because in the barn there was, as I grew up, there was gill nets out there in barrels that he'd give up with, see. He was interested in dragging, so put those up there in the barrel and they stayed there. Put the salt to them and they stayed there.
They wouldn't spoil if they were kept salted?
No, you had to salt them in order to keep them. Even though you dry them out, they get salt all through them, so you put more salt and that keeps them from getting damp. See. Mm-hmm. Well, it makes them damp, I guess, but keeps them from rotting. That was right after the war. They decided the factory down east wanted scales so they get the shiny off of it. So when we rigged up the Ruth Mary there, we put on a scale separator. And we had a pumper that would lower down into the fish after the mother boat had the fish all curled up in the net, see, and dried them up so you could get at them. So we put that pumper down in the amongst those fish and then pump it out. Well, we had to have a separator so that keep the water going overboard, separate the water from the fish, and the fish would go down a chute into the hole. That'd fill the hole of the boat up quicker than we used to go with a brailing net with a big dip net. So then we had a market for scales if we could figure out how to get them, so that we had to make a separator box for them. And that was a little extra money to make off the night's trip, selling the scales to the scale company. Let's see, they made shiny out of it. Made all kinds of stuff out of it. Jewelry and some of the food has it in it, even. And it was quite a business.
They're still doing that, then?
Oh, I suppose so. But we don't have much of a business with herring nowadays.
Mm.
But I think they still do it down east.
No other fish do they do that with?
Oh, you can in any other fish, because the scales get that shiny on it. But herring was worse the most, because you could handle it, and you handle a lot of herring, and you get a lot of scales out of pumping them from the herring.
And you wouldn't be pumping your other fish then?
No, not really. In fact, some of them learned the technique of tying a lot of rope with knots on it every so far apart, throwing them in the stream of fish and water coming, being pumped up. And that would shake more scales off of them than ordinarily. Yeah. I don't think it helped the fish much. Probably made them worse. Probably made them softer, you know, having those ropes in there with knots on it. But
now, the quality of fish was very, very important when you bring it in and the buyers are looking at it. Do you ever have buyers turn down a load and say it looked too old or
sure.
Whatever?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, you had to take care of them once you got them aboard and dressed them. You had to pack them down, pack plenty of ice on them. You couldn't go out there without ice and expect to bring fish in because they would be too soft.
Did you have to gut all the fish, or were some species that landed whole?
Well, herring was landed whole, and whiting was landed whole. The rest of them, they were bigger fish, so we always dressed them. Dogfish was landed whole. But we'd fish for those day and be in that night, and they would take them out for the women to cut that night. Herring, see, you had to get them in there early in the morning so the women, when they come to work, they could pack them. So, whiting, we had fish with father 3-4 years when the whiting showed up here. And we'd get in as soon as we could, but usually we wasn't home till summertime. And they'd pump them out, and they'd call the women in to work on them that night. which hopefully they could get them all, get enough women so they take care of the whole lot of them that night. See.
So, are you saying that whiting was also?
Well, there was a fish we had to catch in the day. Mm-hmm. Now herring, you see, you could catch them in the night, and they'd be in your pound, sold at any time of day, whether day or night. They was in there. They could pump them out and get them to the factory, but they'd like to have them early in the morning.
Mm, yeah.
See.
What was the whiting fishery for?
The whiting fishery was for, it's nice white meat. I don't know what the biggest market was for it, but...
But it was a food fish and not for lobster bait or anything like that.
Right, no. But the cuttings, all these factories that was handling fish, the cuttings was used as a rendering. They would render it for meal in the rendering plants. There was three or four of them in Rockland. But also you could buy cuttings for lobster bait. And now we don't have that, see. All they have is herring now for lobster bait.
Is it because the ground fishery has gone down so low there's not enough of them around, or is it just they prefer herring?
Well, herring is easier to handle, so it is preferred. But when the factories were working, it was cheaper to buy a bushel of cuttings than it was herring, see? And they would buy that when herring was scarce also. So they kept them supplied with bait year-round. Right now, we're putting a terrible strain on herring because they don't have enough herring for bait. And the other thing is, when I was a kid growing up, my father used to go lobstering in the winter. Mm-hmm. 200 traps was a big string of traps. That's about all you could handle, two men. We'd go out there and haul those. If we was lucky, we got them all hauled that one day. But if we didn't get them all hauled that day, we'd either come home because it was getting nasty, or we'd go into Matinicus because my grandfather lived there, him and his grandmother. Mm-hmm. And we'd go out the next day if it was good and finish the trip. We'd get the all 200 hauls. That was a big day's work. We hauled it on a winch head like you saw out there, and that's a lot slower than these power winches now. So all you do is just put the rope in there, and she'll come up there. You can sling it in faster than you can handle it. Mm-hmm. You can also put too much strain on it and pat them, see, so you have to put a little bit, use a little judgment. But they could haul so much faster now, and they put long trawls out. They put 9-10 traps on a trawl, one after the other comes aboard.
So you can get 800, 1,200, whatever number of traps that you could...
Well, you can put them all in 10 trap trawls, buoy on each end, see, so you don't lose them. Mm-hmm. But you can put all 10 on deck, or you might have 12 on a trawl or something, like they're out on the edges of charges in that deep water. They have quite a few, whatever the boat will handle. So they're doing that around here now. Well, when I went with father and I was younger then, nobody had trawls like that. Sometimes we had two on a buoy line, but that was most we ever had. Hmm. Then up Portland way, they started with trawls up there. They would have three or four on buoy line.
And then it kind of came up the coast?
Well, you would think it would, but they made a law against having trawls this side of Pemaquid, I think. The west of Pemaquid, from there to Portland, like that. All of them had trawls, but this side, they didn't. They just had two traps on a buoy line, but that's not all. So I think they made a rule in up in Augusta against having trawls down here at the east of...
But from what you're saying, the herring are being, there's a bigger demand for herring all the time then.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You got
and not only that, what's you'll notice in a lot of the herring bait is a lot of mackerel, so they're getting caught up with them. Our Georgia is catching a lot of little small haddock that was starting to grow up, and that's getting crowded in there. You can't separate them. They haven't figured a way to separate them, you know, so they'd live. So it's all going into
the young haddock are living in amongst the herring then.
They're feeding on it.
Mm.
Well, herring is feed for all these other fish anyway. See? So they get caught up with them and goes right into the bait.
Do you think if the herring fishery were cut way down, that the groundfish and other fish, like you're saying, would have more feed and they'd tend to come back more?
They kind of have more feed if somebody catches them.
No, I'm saying if they stop the herring fishery, no one's going to
do that.
Well,
they won't stop it. Lobster catching industry is in such a demand for bait, they won't stop that.
No.
You could never get them to go stop that one.
Very healthy part of the economy. Guys that are lobstering.
Well, it is. But like, for instance, out here, right outside that island, when I was a teenager growing up, father fished out there summer after summer and made a good living right there in a little boat. And he sold to the wharf down in here. That was Pete Reed. And Pete Reed sold to the local stores that wanted his fish. Those that they didn't want, he put them in barrels and iced them and sent them to Boston every night, see. So it was a nice little business. But all the day long, Father and I would drag out there to catch fish, and in amongst the fish was this big bag of trash, which was little sculpins and little skates and little monkfish and little eels and all that stuff. And what a job pick that mess over. So they had rendering plants in Rockland, three of them. Rendering plants would take fish cuttings, and they would cook them up and make meals, see. So when they didn't have enough cuttings to keep them going day after day, they would take trash fish out here on the bottom.
Just mixed in with the bag.
So they were mixed in with the bag, and were quite a job to pick it over to get the good fish out of it, see. And those there would shovel it over. Well, then... Now, this is ridiculous. When you get a bigger boat, like the Ethel B, he had more room, he could carry stuff. So we would save those in the pen away from the good fish, bring them in and pump them out in the...
In the rendering plant.
Rendering plant. Why? We thought we were doing something great. We was. We were cleaning that place up. And after 4 or 5 years, you could go out there and fish, and there would be some, when the good fish showed up, you caught some and there wasn't all this trash with it. Now...
I say sculpins are big cod egg eaters anyway. And all that, you know.
They ain't the only thing that eat them. But all the fish we dressed out here in the bay, quite often in the spring, out of the stomachs come these little shells. Crabs, lobsters, small fish. We're catching an awful lot of... Oh, what do you want to call them? You call them mad eaters, I guess, because they was eating all the little shells and young ones being growed up, see? Especially the lobsters, because the last 10 years, this bay here has produced more lobsters than any other gulf in the coast. Well, we cleaned up all those trash fish that was feeding on them. We thought we was cleaning up those trash fish so we could go... drag in for good fish, you know, without being hindering with it. And we thought we were doing something big. I'm not so sure it was so big.
They all might have had some purpose in down there.
Oh, they did. They was feeding on every little crab or every little lobster or anything that was along there. That's why those lobsters survive now. Of course, you can't make a lobster catcher believe it, but I know what it is.
In other words, The baby lobsters have so few predators now, then.
That's right, exactly. They get a chance to grow up. Finally, they came about 10 years ago. They come up this channel and get good a size, better size. They go down in the wintertime when they get cold into the deeper water, and then they come back up again. And they were getting the big stock of lobsters and good a size that you could take to market.
Mm-hmm.
We had several years of very good lobstering. Whether it'll keep up going, who knows? Everything goes in a cycle, and we got no control over it other than we can destroy it, and we have changed it some. Dragon has changed it. I don't know what else. But
you think
any
things
pollution
can bounce?
Will raise hell, huh?
Things can bounce back and up and down, you're saying?
Well, hopefully they will. I don't know if they will in my lifetime, probably not, but hopefully they can. As soon as they show up, we know it. We go catch it to make a living. We put it on the market, but you can only catch that one fish once and sell it once to the market. You can't do it again. I mean, catch another one, but you can't catch that same fish. So they take the records that we have of what we put fish in the market. That tells how good it is out there, see? But who knows? We might have caught up that whole family of fish, you know, this week. Next week he's not there because he's gone to market. So how do they can justify what's going to come next year? I don't see how they can. They can keep us away and let those fish grow, which makes sense. There's got nothing against that because we understand that they have cycles. And that's all right if they want to control it that way. But if it's not controlled, somebody else come in there and try them because they know there's fish there this year, even though we left them alone because those fish haven't quite grown up yet. So they can still sell them if they catch them. So that's why they'll go in there and catch them. So, gracious, if that's our livelihood, it's going to be for our livelihood 2-3 years from now. Maybe we better not wait till they get too big. Maybe we better catch them before somebody else does. What a racket, huh?
Yeah, but it would. So it is possible then for this inshore ground fishery to come back, at least till it gets, till you, as you say, someone comes by and.
Yeah, well, I hope he does. I like Uncle Phil. He did all this trawling up along the coast, up in the river. You know, going from Camden up to Lincolnville, going up Northport and all those places. Well, all those places where it was little. A little bedroom for fish, I guess you want to call it. Well, the fish would hatch in there, and they'd grow up, and they get better over the 2-3 years. But if somebody found them and they fished them out, they'd be gone till another school got hatched in or something. But that could come back because there's nobody disturbing the fish much up the river, I don't believe. Like Uncle Phil, he isn't. He hasn't done that for 10 years. He's gone now, but it's quite a while ago since he last went up there to catch a fish. Yeah.
Do you know that up toward Winterport, all the way up to the river there, some researchers put out some nets just to check. They check every 5 years or so to see, and this for the first time in like 30 years, they caught just sturgeon after sturgeon after sturgeon.
Did they?
Yeah.
That's good to know.
And that somehow that nice, flat, marshy sort of where the rivers are all slowed down, and that's just what they want, I guess.
Yeah. There used to be a lot of sturgeon down off Booth Bay. Mm-hmm. See, that's the river the other side of Booth Bay. It goes up in, way up into Bath, those places. Well, we used to drag outside of there, and every once in a while you get a nice big sturgeon. Well, he come down out of the river. We knew where they come from, but we never went up the river much. So we knew they were sturgeon there. Maybe they'll come back there. So.
And I guess that if these are up in the Penobscot River, they must come down. I'm sure they just aren't river fish.
No, probably not. But I don't ever remember catching one outside the island here. We never did. But Bob Dow caught a few. Well, he caught them down off Booth Bay.